From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Let's check in on the House Judiciary Committee hearing, which is underway as lawmakers weigh the case for impeaching President Trump. The president is accused of using the power of his office for personal political gain. And today, Noah Feldman of Harvard Law School said the framers of the Constitution would view the president's actions as impeachable.
If the framers were aware that a president of the United States had put his personal gain and interest ahead of the national security of the United States by conditioning aid to a crucial ally that's in the midst of a war on investigations aimed at his own personal gain, they would certainly conclude that that was an abuse of the office of the presidency, and they would conclude that that conduct was impeachable under the Constitution.
One of the four witnesses at today's hearing, NPR's congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, is on Capitol Hill watching all of this. Claudia, what more are witnesses saying, or what stood out to you so far?
Yeah, so this panel of professors are telling lawmakers that they have all the evidence they need in order to proceed in this critical decision on whether to draw up articles of impeachment. It's a panel of four legal scholars, three of which were called by the Democrats, and they're saying the evidence uncovered so far shows President Trump used military aid to extract a personal favor in the form of interference on his behalf for the 2020 elections. These professors are saying that's exactly the kind of behavior that the framers of the Constitution had in mind when it came to impeachment. And they all agree this is a clear-cut case for impeachment.
Three of them do, but one of them doesn't, and that would be the Republicans' witness, Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School. He is against the idea of impeachment. Let's listen to him.
I believe this impeachment not only fails to satisfy the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments.
Claudia, Professor Turley said he didn't vote for President Trump. He thinks the president's action with Ukraine deserved to be investigated. But what is his issue with impeachment?
He says lawmakers need to meet a higher threshold to prove President Trump has committed a crime. He said there isn't enough evidence from the Intelligence Committee probe to prove that the president committed bribery or obstruction. He says Trump has used the courts to defend himself, and he has that option, he even turned it around. And he said Democrats are abusing their power.
Republicans have been interrupting the hearing for procedural issues. Here's Democratic Committee Chair Gerald Nadler pushing through some of those bumps.
The gentleman will suspend. That is not a proper parliamentary inquiry.
It is a proper.
It is not a proper parliamentary
inquiry. I stated a rule. I stated a rule,
Mr. Chairman. You can ignore it and not answer it, but you can't just say it's not a proper
inquiry. I'm asking for the application of the rule for an explanation, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how that's not parliamentary.
We will apply the rules, period.
Claudia, what is the point of this strategy by Republicans?
So Republicans have focused on judiciary as an opportunity to kind of slow the flow of the hearing, disrupt the Democrats' major arguments that they're hoping to present today. And they think if they are able to cause this confusion, blur the Democrats' arguments, then Republicans believe it's an effective way to throw Democrats off their game and make the argument for impeachment that much more unclear to those who are listening in.
After today's hearing in the Judiciary Committee, what happens next? Will there be more hearings?
Well, that remains to be seen. Judiciary is keeping those details very close to the vest. They're not saying quite yet. We may hear more by the end of the week if they will set additional hearings, if there will be fact witnesses, or if it'll be more examination of the investigation. We still need to hear from the Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, who will be presenting his panel's findings to Judiciary, which is needed before that critical decision of drafting articles of impeachment.
And when would that happen, the drafting of the articles of impeachment?
So we're hearing that it could potentially happen in the next couple of weeks. Many Democrats have been hoping to wrap up this process by the Christmas holiday. And in order to do that, those articles need to be drawn up in the coming weeks. I talked to one Democratic lawmaker this morning, and their sense was it could happen the week of the 16th of December.
And if the House votes to impeach the president this month, do we know anything more about what the process in the Senate would be?
Yeah, so now that pushes the process to a Senate trial, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said that they would move forward with a trial of some kind. It could last several weeks. The president and White House officials have been meeting with Republicans over the last several weeks as well to kind of map out a strategy of what that could look like. And yeah, that could move into the new year, and we could see that happen then.
Well, I will say there's been one light moment today in the hearings, which is that Jonathan Turley, the Republican witness, said that his golden doodle was mad, just like everybody else that he was referencing about President Trump. And there's already been a Twitter handle of Jonathan Turley's golden doodle Luna that has popped up. And she's tweeting quite a lot.
Oh, fantastic. A new celebrity.
A new celebrity. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales on Capitol Hill. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Jeremy. Well, all that was happening. President Trump says he's leaving the NATO summit in London today earlier than planned. He said he was canceling his afternoon press conference and going back to Washington, but not before he took a dig at Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Well, he's two-faced.
Do you think that Germany is too naive?
And honestly, with Trudeau, he's a nice guy. I find him to be a very nice guy. But, you know, the truth is that I called him out on the fact that he's not paying 2%, and I guess he's not very happy about it. I mean, you were there, a couple of you were there, and he's not paying 2%, and he should be paying 2%. It's Canada. They have money.
Trump was taking questions from reporters alongside German Chancellor Angela Merkel, calling on Trudeau to pay 2% of Canada's GDP to support NATO. Now, he made the comment after a video last night appeared to show Trudeau making fun of Trump for turning a photo op earlier that day into a lengthy press conference. Jane Harman is president and CEO at the Wilson Center. She's also a former ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Jane Harman, welcome. And first of all, your thoughts. The leaders at this NATO meeting desperately wanted to avoid drama. And yet here we are, President Trump calling Trudeau two-faced. And that was just one of the awkward moments in London this week.
Yes, it was. But there were many on both sides or all sides. So let's be fair and balanced here. It was Macron, the president of France, who called NATO brain dead. That started it off. Then Trump had to defend NATO. Then there was the two-faced comment. So, yeah, the words were flying loose. What's sad is that rather than think about NATO as brain dead, let's think about it as brain cell challenge. Mm-hmm. The brain cells of the members need to be focused on the urgent problems and external threats rather than on managing the personalities.
Well, in fact, the Secretary General of NATO said today that despite all this, that member countries stand together all for one and one for all. I mean, is that believable? How would you gauge the unity?
You know, let us remember 18 years ago, I certainly do, that right after 9/11, NATO invoked Article 5 to protect the United States. They didn't even ask us. So they invoked Article 5 for us. I think we owe something back. It is a common defense, a mutual defense organization. I think the threats that NATO faces are also threats that we face. I think NATO does need refurbishing, but I think that the basic concept of NATO is sound and needs to be constantly respected.
And let's talk a little bit more about that. President Trump's main concern seems still to be whether or not member countries are paying enough to support the alliance. And you mentioned these threats that are very real, Russia, China, and the like. Is all that a distraction? Or is NATO paying close enough attention to those threats?
Well, today, as I understand it, NATO was talking about some of the emerging threats, one of which is cyber and the other of which is China. But I think Trump's cash register theory of NATO is not, to me, the most important part of NATO. The important thing to focus on is the common defense aspect and reinventing NATO as a modern defense organization against threats like cyber.
And what should be done about Turkey? NATO, as you know, has serious issues with Turkey, the attacks on the Kurds in northern Syria, and then buying a missile defense system from the Russians. So what about the threat of potentially one of its own members?
The Turkey issue is very serious. I think our current position with Turkey is wrong. I do not think we should have announced the pullout of some troops from Syria. We had been negotiating an adequate safety zone, and then all of a sudden, President Trump announced that we were pulling our troops out and gave Turkey free rein along that border, and now Turkey is doing exercises with Russia along that border. And certainly there are reports of human rights violations, as a lot of innocent civilians, or allegedly, were harmed in that non-safety zone.
So what should NATO do about it?
I think that NATO should condemn Turkey's actions in that border area of Syria, or at least the allegations that there were human rights violations. I think that would be appropriate. And secondly, Turkey buying this S-400 from Russia, I think was a highly inappropriate action. First of all, Russia and Russian incursions into some NATO states is one of the external challenges that NATO has to face up to. But second of all, I think that's a thumb in the eye of the other NATO states. I think what would be appropriate at this point, at least, is for Turkey to agree not to deploy the system.
That's Jane Harman, President and CEO at the Wilson Center. Jane, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
President Trump is headed back to Washington, where the next phase of the impeachment inquiry is underway. In a public hearing today of the House Judiciary Committee, Republicans and Democrats are starkly divided about whether Trump has committed impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hiya.
And Matt Mikowiak, Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
Okay, so the Judiciary Committee is hearing from four constitutional scholars today, and three of them were brought by the Democrats, one by the Republicans. UNC professor Michael Gerhardt says the president engaged in serious misconduct, including bribery. But George Washington University professor Jonathan Turley, who the Republicans brought in, said impeachment would be an historic mistake.
President Trump will not be our last president. And what we leave in the wake of this scandal will shape our democracy for generations to come. I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger.
Jamal, is this hearing a successful one for the Democrats, given that you've got these scholars with different views up there?
I think this hearing is just fine. It's laying out the case that Democrats are trying to make, that these are impeachable offenses. I mean, but keep in mind, before we get caught in the process, the substance of what is at stake really does matter. And I was just looking up when Rod Blagojevich, the governor of Illinois, was convicted of 17 counts. One of those counts was conspiracy to solicit a bribe, which is precisely the thing that it appears Donald Trump was doing until the whistleblower blew the whistle and Congress began to investigate and a crime in progress was stopped and the president released the money to Ukraine. That's what's at stake here. And I think the Democrats made that case during the Intelligence Committee hearings.
Matt, what do you make of today's hearing?
Well, first of all, I think it's been painfully dull. And I imagine very few people have been able to sit through and watch most of this. You know, people who go to law school hate constitutional law, and you're seeing why today in this hearing. One of the things I think is interesting is the difference between how this was conducted in the Clinton impeachment and how it's being conducted now. In the Clinton impeachment, you had the articles voted out of the Judiciary Committee. You had the articles presented fully in the Judiciary Committee, and then you brought in the constitutional law experts to analyze the articles. That's not what's happening here. This hearing almost feels like a filler, like a delay, almost a delay tactic on behalf of the Democrats. They're not really sure what they want to do yet. They had a caucus meeting this morning, talked about it. There's some movement towards a censure, some movement towards delaying past Christmas, some movement towards doing it before Christmas. And I just don't see how this hearing really moves the ball down the field from their perspective. I think Turley's testimony has been compelling. He's gone back and analyzed the statutes and looked at the history and just doesn't – not only does he not see a crime, but he doesn't believe this is meets the threshold of impeachment. And he goes through it in a really quite detailed and substantive way, and this is not someone who's a Trump supporter. So I don't really know what the Democrats are trying to accomplish today, but I don't think they're succeeding.
Well, Jamal, what do you think about that, about what Matt just said? Because the previous hearings in the Intelligence Committee were so much different. These were fact-based witnesses who gave their accounts of, you know, the alleged wrongdoing by the president and his close aides. Do you think anyone will be moved by a panel of legal scholars?
Oh, I don't think that this is meant to be in the moving question. This is, you know, there is a process here, and I think Democrats are trying to lay down exactly what the process is. There is a legal argument. Listen, Elijah Cummings said this before he passed away. This is our watch. And the one thing that Democrats are keenly aware of is that history will pay attention to this. And it is not the House Democrats' responsibility to absolve Senate Republicans of their constitutional responsibility. The House Democrats are interested in making sure they are holding the president accountable. History will know that. And frankly, I think the voters will know that. And that will, and even if the Senate does not do its job, voters will be very clear. This is an impeached president. Do we want to return him to office?
Matt, I want to ask you about these dueling reports that came out of the Intelligence Committee. The Democrats' version last night had phone call records in it that show President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, repeatedly called the White House Budget Office, perhaps the president himself. There was a mysterious -1 phone number in there. That's all it said. Also, his indicted Soviet-born associate, Lev Parnas, and ranking member, ranking Republican Devin Nunes. Are these suspicious to you? Are these phone calls a problem for the president?
I don't think so. I don't know why Giuliani would be talking to OMB. I do think that perhaps raises questions. But the rest of it, I don't think you can make very much of. You know, the president would talk to his personal attorney. I don't know why that's some big revelation.
What about Devin Nunes, though, the person who's very closely involved with these impeachment hearings?
Yeah, I mean, he said he doesn't remember ever talking on the phone to Lev Parnas, that he didn't know who he was at the time. He's only known who he was once he was indicted. So that's what his what's what he's saying. I know the phone records may show something different. I don't really have any thoughts on that are all that specific, just because I don't know what to, quite to make of it. So I think in some ways this is Democrats trying to bring out a shiny new object to try to cast, you know, more questions and doubt over all the players and what people were doing. If they had a strong argument, if they had proven a crime, if they had a victim, if they had, you know, were moving public opinion in their direction, they would be sticking to that argument. Every day it's something new. Today they're talking about treason. They were talking about bribery during the public phase. They were talking about a quid pro quo the weeks before that during the private depositions that the Intelligence Committee was holding. They keep kind of changing their approach, and I think that's because nothing that they've done has really stuck yet.
Well, let's listen to Devin Nunes defending himself about the call records. This is him in an interview on Fox News last night with Sean Hannity.
Did you ever talk to this guy, Les Parnas, or whoever his name is?
You know, it's possible, but I haven't gone through all my phone records. I don't really recall that name. You know, I remember the name now because he's been indicted.
Jamal, what are your thoughts on this?
It's interesting that nobody knows Lev Parnas, but apparently he's got all these pictures with the president. He's got phone calls with senior House members. He's been palling around town with Rudy Giuliani in and out of the Trump Hotel. You know, it's just amazing the amount of amnesia that's taking place around this. But what we know is the president of the United States went on George Stephanopoulos' show on June 17th and said he would gladly take opposition research help from a foreign government. And then the White House chief of staff went on television from the White House podium and said, we do quid pro quos all the time. There is politics and foreign policy. Get over it. And now we know that the president of the United States was withholding aid to a ally because until he got political help, opposition research on one of his opponents. So not only was he willing to accept help, he actually was soliciting that help, which could be constituted as a bribe, as a thing of value in order to help the president personally, not to help the country, but to help the president's political campaign.
Okay, let's just turn away from impeachment and everything related to it for a moment to talk about 2020, because Kamala Harris, the only African-American woman in the 2020 Democratic presidential race, dropped out yesterday. Jamal, I'm going to go back to you because you're the Democrat here. Why did she fail, and what does it mean for the race?
First of all, Kamala Harris is a phenomenal politician who I think has proven herself over a lifetime of work to be very good. Running for president is very hard. Most people fail at it. In fact, almost everybody fails at it, right? Except for the one person that gets elected. So I want to give her some credit for putting her name in the ring. What was tough for her campaign, I think, was that they never quite got a direct clear message about what they were up to, what it was she was sort of fighting for in the electorate. A move from power of the people to 3 a.m. phone calls to something, some other things. There were some organizational challenges that they had. Again, running for president is very hard, and most people don't do it well.
Matt, how are Republicans feeling about how this race is thinning out on the Democratic side?
Yeah, the kind of state of the Democratic primaries is subject to my Washington Times column for tomorrow. I'll be honest, a month ago, I thought it was highly likely Elizabeth Warren would be the nominee. And I'll freely admit I don't understand the Democrats as well as Jamal does. But I can analyze candidate strengths, tactics, strategy, you know, the basic ways we evaluate candidates. And it seems to me right now that this is a wide open race. I think the New York Times just in the last couple of days suggested that it's possible that different candidates could win the first four contests. That's obviously never happened. It also seems to me that the top four candidates, if you consider, you know, Biden, Warren, Sanders, and Buttigieg, the top four in any order, they all have, you know, some problem associated with their candidacy, something that's keeping them from becoming the overwhelming frontrunner. And so that kind of scenario does present an opportunity for someone like Mike Bloomberg, who's trying something that's never been tried, which is skipping the first four states and then self-funding Super Tuesday. So, look, I think obviously the beating heart of the Democratic Party has moved left. That's where they are on their issues and on the platform. There's, you know, candidates that are more mainstream like Biden and Buttigieg. There are candidates that are more liberal like Warren and Sanders. We'll see how it works out. But this looks to me like this primary is going to go on a while, perhaps all the way to the convention because of the way they allocate delegates proportionally. I feel like this race is more uncertain now than it's been at any time in the last 3 months.
Well, Jamal, let me ask you just finally about Michael Bloomberg, because there's no question that if he were not a billionaire, he would not be anywhere in the polls right now jumping in this late. The reason he's been able to do that is because he spent $50 million in the last couple of weeks. Do you have a problem with a billionaire being able to jump into the race like that and maybe have a shot at being the nominee?
He spent more money in the last few weeks than Kamala Harris raised, right? Twice as much, in fact, than Kamala Harris raised the entire campaign. Listen, anybody can run for president. It's great. I did my show today, Why You Should Care, for Hill TV, is going to be about this partially. You know, because Sergey Brin and Larry Page from Google got out and somebody suggested that they run for president, too.
Right.
You know, most people do not think billionaires should be the ones who run the Democratic Party, particularly after the financial crisis of 2008, 2009.
Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
36 states have laws that prevent local governments from enacting their own gun regulations. Pennsylvania is one of those states, and its two largest cities have tried unsuccessfully to pass ordinances to control guns. Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, where 11 people were killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue last year. WESA's Ariel Worthy reports.
After the shooting, Dana Kellerman, a worshiper at another congregation housed inside the Tree of Life building, knew something needed to change. So she helped form a local gun control advocacy group.
It's the responsibility of the state of Pennsylvania, which has failed abysmally, and it is the responsibility of Congress, which has also failed to do anything.
It was because of the work of advocates like her that Pittsburgh was able to pass its own gun control ordinances. For Kellerman, enough is enough.
We have largely moved to a point where we want action. We want action on gun violence, and we want action on white supremacy and anti-Semitism.
Kellerman says she and other Pittsburgh residents formed their organization to make sure other communities don't have to endure the same pain they did. And they were prepared to fight for gun control laws at the state level after the courts halted the Pittsburgh ordinances. But then Republican Representative Rob Kaufman, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, said the legislature wouldn't take up any more gun bills this session.
We believe in the Second Amendment and law-abiding citizens' right to bear arms and keep arms in Pennsylvania.
In fact, it's even harder now for municipalities to defend their own gun laws because of a bill the committee recently passed. But Democratic Governor Tom Wolf says,
we've got to get out of denial and start to address the issue. And that's all I'm talking about. And I think there are the majority of Pennsylvanians actually want to do something.
He threatened to veto the bill. In a recent interview with member station WHYY, Wolf said residents have the right to go in public without fear of gun violence.
We ought to have universal background checks. We ought to address the gun show loophole in Pennsylvania. We ought to ban assault weapons. We ought to have passed the red flag law.
Red flag laws, formally known as extreme risk protection orders, are active in 17 states in Washington, D.C. They allow law enforcement to take guns away after a court rules someone is a threat to themselves or others. In Pennsylvania, some Republican state representatives have lobbied for red flag laws in cases of suicide, like Representative Todd Stevens. He sponsored one bill that ultimately didn't pass.
My bill's been referred to as gun confiscation, and I explain to people that under my proposal, everybody gets their guns back someday. You know, the longest that you could lose them for is a year.
But Kaufman, the Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee, made it clear that he and his colleagues won't address the bills.
We will not be considering red flag in the House Judiciary Committee so long as Chairman Kaufman is chairman.
Meanwhile, in Pittsburgh, local activist Kellerman says the impact is still in the early stages.
Personally, I will be okay. There are families who this will be with them forever.
The mayor of Pittsburgh has said multiple times that the city is prepared to fight for their gun laws in the state's capital of Harrisburg. And they are doing just that after local courts block the laws and they prepare to appeal the decision to the state court. For NPR News, I'm Ariel Worthy in Pittsburgh.
At last count, there were 552,830 homeless people in the United States. 35% were unsheltered. Homelessness is a problem that many major cities struggle with, and natural disasters that destroy homes and displace people cause the number of homeless to swell. In New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, homelessness more than doubled. In 2007, 2 years after the storm, there were more than 11,600 homeless people in New Orleans. But since then, the city has reduced homelessness by 90%. In February, I spoke with Martha Cagle, who's the executive director of Unity of Greater New Orleans. That's a nonprofit collaborative that provides housing and services to the homeless. So 90%, that sounds pretty impressive. What has New Orleans done to have that kind of success?
So we faced, you know, just an unprecedented explosion in homelessness. And we basically, you know, relied on three major factors to really bring down homelessness. First, we assembled what I'd have to describe as a kick-ass outreach team that was willing to go anywhere and do anything to rescue and rehouse a homeless person. Secondly, we really put together a pot of rent assistance because the answer to homelessness is housing.
Right.
People tend to not understand that, but it really is about providing housing. And then the third thing is really about targeting that housing to the people who need it the most. And we take an approach which has been widely adopted around the country, but wasn't adopted at the time that we were first approaching this a decade ago, and that's called Housing First. And it's simply the idea that you accept people as they are, and you don't expect them to necessarily be clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
You don't expect them to be able to take their psychiatric medication while they're out on the street, but you just accept them as they are, and you provide the housing first. Then once they're in their apartment, you immediately wrap all the services around them that they need to stay stable and live the highest quality life that they can live.
But how do you afford that? Because in order to provide housing first, you've got to have a house and you've got to have something that will pay for that.
Actually, this is a very cost-effective approach because when you think about it, it is costing the taxpayer a tremendous amount of money to leave people on the street because they're constantly cycling in and out of jail, on charges that wouldn't even be relevant if they had an apartment, things like urinating in public, drinking in public, obstructing the sidewalk because they're having to sleep on the sidewalk, homeless offenses, in other words, that are costing the taxpayers a lot of money to be putting them in jail and processing them through the criminal justice system. Their health is deteriorating while they're out on the street, so they're being taken by ambulance to the emergency room mm-hmm. constantly. Those are huge charges, and really what you need is, you know, a relatively small amount of money to pay for some rent assistance, and they can contribute some of that rent as well with disability benefits or if they're able to work with, you know, employment income and a little bit of case management assistance. It really has been proven over and over again in studies to be very cost effective.
And what's the long-term solution? How long do the people that you have helped end up staying in these, I would assume, temporary housing situations?
They're not temporary. This is permanent this housing. Is permanent. How long the rent assistance lasts depends on what people need. And we're kind of masters at trying to spread what is always an inadequate amount of money as far as it'll spread. So there are many people who do have serious mental health issues. Those folks may very well need rent assistance and case management for the rest of their lives. But others, particularly families, for example, the parent may be young and maybe lost her job, and she's evicted and she ends up having to sleep in her car with her kids. That situation, we might provide rent assistance for a period of months. Then what we have found is that she's able to make it on her own after that. So we really individually triage people and give them what they need to stay stable and then assist the next person.
Another thing New Orleans has done is it's ended veteran homelessness, right?
Well, we have reached what we call functional zero, which mm-hmm. means that we compiled a list using our outreach team, using our shelter lists that are updated every night. And we housed in their own apartments every veteran on that list, except 9 that had refused housing, mostly because of mental illness. And we continued to work with those 9 at that point, have housed 4 more of them. And then going forward, we have made a commitment that anytime a veteran becomes newly homeless, we house them in an apartment within an average of 30 days or less. And we've maintained that now for over 4 years, and we're extremely proud of that. It is very hard work. It requires a lot of organizations working together, and the VA and the Housing Authority, everybody working together to make that happen. We've also reduced the length of time that any homeless family spends homeless to less than 45 days. And we're working on bringing that number down because the research shows that, you know, even the best run shelter is no place for a kid to be.
What are the challenges that still remain in New Orleans, or what's the biggest challenge that you have at this point in trying to get that 90% to 100% of homelessness eliminated?
Well, we still have a relatively high proportion of our homeless people having to live outside. And, you know, it's just something that we're constantly struggling with. It seems almost as if for every person that we house, that someone new is appearing. And that's because of this affordable housing crisis, the gentrification that we're facing. And so we just have to keep at it. We have to keep at it, and we have to ask government at all levels to do more to provide housing resources. We have to have housing for the elderly. We have to make sure that children aren't homeless. That's part of being a healthy community and a country that has a moral core.
I want to ask you one more thing, Martha Cagle, which is, what is the one thing that you've done that you, when you look at other cities or other places in the country that are dealing with homelessness that they haven't done, that you would say, this is the first thing you need to do?
I think at its core that tackling homelessness is really about knowing and loving your community. You have to love the people in your community and want your community to thrive and care very deeply about the vulnerable people in it, that you're willing to do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes is what you have to do. It's amazing how housing can almost instantly change a person.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a woman, for example, who was very paranoid, schizophrenic. She was sleeping outside in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant for about 10 years and had refused assistance, which isn't actually the typical thing. Most homeless people want to be housed, but she was actually very difficult to help. And we finally had an apartment that we thought would appeal to her because it had an outdoor courtyard. And we showed her a picture of it, and she actually just got in the outreach van without speaking. She was ready to go. So that day, actually, we were dedicating this apartment building. This was a hot, hot day in late June in New Orleans. But no matter what time of year it was, she was always bundled up in a winter coat, heavy winter coat. Mm-hmm. And she refused to eat the reception food off the plate. Instead, she would pick up scraps of food that had been dropped that were on the concrete floor of the courtyard. Mm. I remember that very clearly, her doing that. Well, that was a Friday. And the following Tuesday, I went in the building and I didn't recognize her, because she had gone with her case manager through this box of donated clothing. And when I saw her, she was wearing just a light cotton floral summer dress. And she looked happy. And I teared up.
Yeah.
You know, it was just such a dramatic thing. And she's been stably, happily housed ever since.
That is Bartha Cagle, who is executive director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, trying to deal with homelessness there in New Orleans and get people into homes. Thank you so much for joining us, Bartha.
Thank you.
Newly unsealed court documents in a lawsuit against the drug maker Purdue Pharma offer new insight into the company's aggressive effort to market its opioid, OxyContin. Nearly 400,000 people have died in the U.S. opioid crisis over the past few decades, and the manufacturers of the drugs have come under increasing legal pressure to take responsibility for the way they pitch their products to doctors and patients. Casey Ross is a reporter for STAT, the health and medicine publication that fought to get those documents unsealed. Casey, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And many of these documents are from the 1990s and include emails from Richard Sackler, the top executive whose family controls the company. What have you learned from them?
Well, what we learned was that in 1997, very soon after OxyContin's release into the market, Dr. Richard Sackler became aware of abuse concerns that were being raised by a large pharmacy benefit management company related to OxyContin, the use of OxyContin specifically in chronic pain patients. And Dr. Sackler at the time urged executives to aggressively push back against those concerns. Specifically, he urged executives to consider giving a presentation that controlled-release products like OxyContin are less prone to addiction potential abuse or diversion than other opioid pain pills. And there wasn't any evidence at the time or since then that that's the case.
Well, one of the big revelations to my mind was that in the early 1990s, Purdue had enrolled 133 elderly patients in a clinical study of the drug. Only 63 of those people completed the trial. And according to these documents, 82% of the patients had adverse side effects from OxyContin. How did the company handle that?
Yeah, this was a study that Purdue relied upon in part to make the case that it could market the product to chronic pain patients. Purdue concluded that the study demonstrated that controlled-release oxycodone, as in OxyContin, is safe and effective for the control of osteoarthritis pain. And in a plea agreement, in a statement of facts that was later reached in a settlement with Purdue, Purdue acknowledged that it used the osteoarthritis study to make claims in part that the patients who used the drug were less subject to withdrawal symptoms, which was found to be a deceptive marketing practice.
And just to be clear, it was very important for the company at the time to move into this pain management phase outside of what it had traditionally been doing and using the drug for cancer treatment, correct?
Yeah, that was a huge part of the marketing push. Was executives said over and over again in the documents that we reviewed that in order to make OxyContin a success, they had to reach out to chronic pain patients and get the product prescribed to that very large group of people.
And so the marketing campaign went forward full scale. What do these documents tell us about how the company went about doing that, getting this drug to doctors and to the public?
Well, it shows that they created a very aggressive marketing campaign that Dr. Richard Sackler was involved in creating along with other executives at the company to market the product to chronic pain patients and say that, you know, this was the drug that was going to alleviate their concerns and lead to effective treatment of those patients. You know, what we now know is that many decades later, abuse and addiction became a significant problem within the population of patients that were treated. And unfortunately, a lot of people ended up overdosing and dying.
This did happen many years ago. We see that in the late 1990s, a sales rep told the company that they were hearing concerns from doctors that people were mainlining the drug and that it was becoming a street drug. What is the company and the Sackler family saying about all this, these new documents that are out now?
Well, they're saying in relation to the document, which we cited at the top of the story, that Richard Sackler became aware of abuse concerns and urged a presentation, you know, to counteract those concerns. They're saying, look, he was just making a suggestion. And in his deposition in 2015 in Kentucky, Dr. Sackler said he didn't know that any such presentation was ever given, but he didn't quite remember how it turned out.
Hmm. And just remind me, where do we stand with the settlements and the lawsuits against this company and many of the other drug manufacturers?
Well, 24 states and thousands of cities around the country are opposing a settlement with the Sackler family on the basis that they don't believe the family is being held financially responsible enough for its role in the harm that's been caused across the country. So we'll have to see how that ends out.
In September, the company offered to settle for $12 billion, but it sounds like you're saying that's not enough, according to the plaintiffs in the case.
Yeah, they're basically saying that statement offered does not include enough of the profits that the Sackler family derived from the drug. They've received about $12 to $13 billion in profits from Purdue. They would eventually pay the plaintiffs about $3 billion. They'd give up control of Purdue and file for bankruptcy. But a lot of the plaintiffs are saying, look, the family is still deriving really substantial profits from the sale of the product, and they believe that they need to give up more of that.
That's Casey Ross with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Casey, thanks very much.
That's my pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.